Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has two matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are number 03-1107, Baskin Family Camp, Inc., DBA, Balcony Springs, Executive Retreat and Conference Center from Vernon County in the 3rd Court of Appeals District. And docket number 040493, In the Interest of KAF, a Child, from Jefferson County in the 9th District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these matters, and the court will take a brief between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded digitally, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day. There is currently one vacancy on the court, which we expect will be filled in the near future. The court is now ready to hear argument in 03-1107 Baskin Family Camps, Inc., versus James Tech Steve.
May it please the court, Ms. Rebecca Bell will present our petition. Petitioners should have 4 minutes for rebuttal.
This is a case of statutory construction, and it is also one of first impression in Texas. The Equine Act presents a broad issue. What is the meaning of the phrase inherent risks of equine activities? In 1995, the legislature passed the Liability for Equine Activities Act. The Equine Act codifies the assumption of the risk doctrine, which is inherent in riding a horse. The express purpose of the act, according to its original bill sponsors and throughout the legislative history, is to protect a growing industry in Texas that commercially and charitably provides horses for equine recreation. Now, this case arose when a rider fell from his horse after the horse broke and ran and then suddenly stopped. The rider filed suit against Baskin Family Camps for negligence. Family Camps asserted multiple defendants, including the limitation of liability found in the Equine Act. Family Camps furthermore sought summary judgment on multiple grounds, including this limitation, and requested the district court construe the statute at issue and determine whether a slipping saddle is an inherent risk of riding a horse.
Does it matter what causes the saddle to slip?
Yeah, I'm answering yes, Your Honor, on that based on the examples from some of our sister states' cases. If it is an atypical slipping of the saddle, as the Cooperman versus Davis case stated, which is a Tenth Circuit case sitting in diversity over a Wyoming statute, in that case, the court said that saddles could slip for many reasons, including a situation where in mounting a horse, while you're trying to mount, the saddle begins to slip off and hangs underneath the belly of the horse. That's not an inherent risk in the activity. But the Cooperman court further distinguished by the fact that when you've traversed the entire trail ride before the slippage occurs, and the rider himself admits that the saddle was comfortable throughout the course of the trail ride, that there was no problem until, as the rider describes it, the horse spontaneously ran and then suddenly stopped, that has to be classified as an inherent risk of the activity.
Is it an inherent risk when the owner of the horse, the owner of the camp, doesn't apply the cinch properly?
Your Honor, that's difficult to answer with the term properly. Just as the Cooperman court noted, cinching a saddle is inherently an imprecise process. There is no scientific precision involved in cinching a horse.
But good horsemen know how to cinch a horse properly.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Good horsemen know how to cinch
a horse to cinch properly. It properly in accordance with the horse. And it's undisputed facts in this case that the equine sponsor and the wrangler at issue cinched the horses twice, particularly this horse at issue, because what we describe as a horse acting like a horse, as Ms. Fisher determined, this horse rose, released air. And so she went back and regirded the horse and cinched it up tighter. But there was no problem with the saddle throughout the entire course of the ride. The rider himself concedes throughout the record that the saddle did not slip until this occurrence. In fact, Your Honor, as the Cooperman court discussed, it depends on how you phrase the question. If the question is, do saddles slip? Is saddle slipping an inherent risk? The answer to that question should be yes.
Well, based on what you just said, I think the answer to that question should be it depends.
Well, but actually, Your Honor, the next way to phrase the question, as the Cooperman Court noted, said, if you're phrasing the question, does a saddle slip because the buckle is broken, an inherent risk? And the answer to that question is no. So I agree with you, Your Honor, that there is sometimes additional words that need to be included in the question, but those words are not terms of negligence.
What if they forget to buckle it properly?
If they don't, if they just forget to buckle it at all, or buckle it properly?
Or just not, well, I don't mean in terms of tightness, but they forget to,
To hook the hooks correctly in the girding process.
And then it comes off.
Your Honor, I think the court would be, or in any court interpreting the facts in that situation, would be in the position of assessing whether this activity, whether the injury occurred because of something the horse did, something the activity performed, or something.
Well, that's my concern, is what's the state of the summary judgment record here? Do we know from the pleadings in the summary judgment record that there's, I had thought there was an allegation that it was not, there was something not hooked up right about it.
No, Your Honor, there's not. In fact, in the amended petition that was filed and incorporated within the motions for summary judgment and responses to it, there are allegations that because the saddle slipped, something must have gone wrong. It's the analysis. If you had done it correctly, the saddle shouldn't have slipped. Therefore, you must not have done it correctly. But what the Court of Appeals did wrong in assessing this and leaping to the factual record was they didn't begin with proper canons of statutory construction. Because if we look to the plain meaning of the statute itself, it answers these questions without us having to create a bright line.
Does this statute protect an owner of a dude ranch that hires an incompetent horse person?
Your Honor, it depends on what the injury is that's resulting. If the injury results from the horse bolting and running,
results from a cinch that's not, or a saddle that's not put on properly.
Well, and Your Honor, I really am not trying to be craftful in how I'm stating this, but it's the exact same situation that the court in Cooperman looked at. And it said that we have to go with the general rule that the saddle slips because of the inherent risk and that you would be protected because cinching a saddle is imprecise. Every single time you cinch a saddle.
Well, what if it puts the bridle on improperly? The bit didn't go in the mouth properly.
And if that is the cause of the injury,
yes.
Your Honor,
can't control the horse.
Your Honor, the Cooperman Court stated the most important involvement, short of being faulty tack, which is an exception, whether it rises to the level of being faulty or defective tack, which would give us a different result. These are what are considered, according to the Cooperman Court, undesirable but collateral risks of horseback riding. We can't control, as the words used within the Court of Appeals and again in the writer's briefing, the issue is not whether it could be controlled or prevented. All of these can be controlled and prevented, Your Honors.
So a customer can't rely upon the owner of this dude ranch to properly equip the horse?
To properly equip the horse? Yes, within the narrow exception found in 87.004, so long as it's not faulty tack or defective equipment. But those are exceptions to the rules. Those assume that we've gotten over the hurdle of inherent risk, which we believe inherent risk of equine activity certainly met in this case. Slipping saddles are an inherent risk of the activity. The question, as the Supone Court noted, which is also a Tenth Circuit case interpreting Wyoming state law, said the question becomes whether it's an atypical situation, whether it's an atypical scenario. For example, mounting a horse, you haven't engaged in the activity yet, and the saddle falls and hangs under the belly of the horse. That was not an inherent risk of the equine activity. It's also important that there's simply these statutes that are relied on that actually include the phrase could not reasonably been prevented, controlled, or altered.
It sounds to me like you conceded that it's possible that a failure to cinch the saddle properly could lead to liability. Is that not your point? Because their petition says one of the allegations of negligence were a failure to properly inspect and secure the saddle before the ride.
Yes, Your Honor, that's one of their negligence allegations, but I don't mean to misstate my position of the law. I think the Cooperman Court is absolutely correct that a slipping saddle is a undesirable but inherent risk of the equine activity.
Yes, but if the saddle was not cinched at all, a failure to secure, you say that would not be grounds for liability.
Well, and, Your Honor, in the Halpern case, which is the only case that said that, has the language of being reasonably prevented, altered, or controlled. It has additional requirements that we don't possess in our statute. It includes the evaluation of could the wrangler have done something different. When you add those words to it, it certainly changes the evaluation of whether it's an inherent risk. After the Halpern case, after that ruling saying, well, perhaps there was another reason for it, the Wyoming legislature amended its statute and it removed those terms because of the Halpern decision.
What if this incident had happened, the horse had not bolted, they were 5 minutes into the ride, and the saddle slipped?
Your Honor, at that point, we'd probably turn to the exceptions to see if there was faulty tack involved, if it was if it rose to the level of Wilton or Wanton behavior.
So those are all fact questions, aren't they?
Well, exceptions of Wilful and Wanton, if they are pleaded and evidence is presented, they could potentially be issues of fact, but those aren't the facts of this case before the court. We don't have allegations of Wilful and Wanton, and we don't have a factual scenario of the saddle slipping early in the race or early in the trail ride. We have exactly the fact pattern of what occurred in Cooperman.
But again, where do we parse it? Are you calling on judges then to decide when in the continuum it would be attributable to operator or error? And I mean, whoever sensed it, error? Or is your answer then that if it were in the first 5 minutes with no bolting or running or anything like that, would have a fact issue as to whether there could be liability under the Act?
No, Your Honor, because I firmly believe, just as the Cooperman Court stated, that this is still a question of law because it goes directly to duty. While we have many statutes, such as the Good Samaritan statute that this court examined in McIntyre versus Ramirez and that I believe both parties rely on for proper canons of statutory construction, if the intent of the legislature was only to protect the rider from these extreme acts, recognizing that the rider assumed that there are a myriad of risks, including undesirable collateral risks, such as slipping saddles.
Well, but courts aren't really equipped to decide whether slipping saddles are an inherent risk of horseback riding, are they? I mean, there's some expert testimony, the wranglers' statements and so forth. Is that what is required for determining this duty issue?
No, Your Honor, it's not. As the legislature has found in the legislative history of this act, it was intended for the statute to be read broadly to cover the sponsor. Everything was to be given an eye with the protection of the sponsor, construed broadly, and if a question of whether it's a propensity of the horse to draw down in favor of the sponsor, with only the exceptions, those narrowly exclusive list of exceptions in 87.004, requiring any sort of factual analysis. The automatic reaction of the court of a horse bolting as a matter of law, because it becomes a question of duty, as a matter of law should determine whether the event fell within the slipping saddle, or in our case, the slipping saddle, but in whatever case, fell within the inherent risk of riding the horse. Volente non fit injuria, Your Honors, it's the principle that I understand the risk that I'm taking in getting on this horse, and I waive any recovery for it. That is the assumption of the risk doctrine that was codified in the statute. If we have a negligence test, as the Court of Appeals erred in this case, the Court of Appeals presupposes that the sponsor would have to show an absence of negligence on its part, any negligence, before triggering the statute. For example, I would have to show, as an equine sponsor, there was absolutely no negligence in me cinching the saddle before I could claim the protections of the statute. But, Your Honors, if I can achieve a finding of no negligence, I don't need the statute. The purpose of the statute was to fill that very gap. In fact, in the letter brief filed by one of the original bill sponsors, whose testimony is found throughout the record before this court, this was intended to broaden the protections and to be construed in favor of the sponsor. If a horse bolts and runs, horses do that. An animal acts like an animal. And if I have to secure a no negligence finding before getting the act protections, I have no need of the act because I have a no negligence finding.
Let me ask you some specific questions and tell me if you believe that in these examples the statute provides immunity because the activities are inherent risks. If the cinch is not, if it's not buckled at all at the beginning of the ride, does that protect Fisher and the camp?
Yes, Your Honor, if it's not buckled at all.
At all.
No, Your Honor, it wouldn't under Cooperman. That is faulty tack.
next example, there's a defect in the buckle. For some reason it latches, but then it doesn't hold.
That would not protect us because of the exception under 87.004.
Let's assume that it's cinched correctly, there's no defect in the equipment, but after some period of time, is it invariably the case that the saddle's going to need to be re-girded, cinched tighter?
It can, depending on the length of the ride, if there needs to be...
I assume it's the ride long enough that you're going to need to re-cinch it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Whose obligation is it then to do that?
Your Honor, it depends on the various duty ranges. A lot of them require a reporting by the rider. I think my saddle's getting a little loose at midpoint breaks. Under the facts of this case, when they were checked at the midpoint ride, I would say the act still covers, protects family camps.
Let's assume it's at the midpoint, there is a re-cinching, a re-girding, mm-hmm. and... it's tightened, but the horse is sweating so much that the saddle still slips.
Yes.
In that situation.
Protected by the act, Your Honor. Just as the Cooperman court stated, and is actually recited by the Court of Appeals in this case, saddles slip for many reasons. Horses sweat, saddles stretch, the saddle pads compress, and riders could have a potential to lean from one side to the other. The record demonstrates that in the rider's own words, this was a spontaneous event. A spontaneous event.
What's the amount of damages alleged?
Your Honor, I don't have that in front of me of the amount of damages. I know it's a significant sum. I'm sure my brief, I apologize for not knowing the amount itself. But what is of particular significance in the line of questioning by Justice, I believe it's Wainwright, is that correct, Your Honor? In that series of questions, there are still opportunities to sue. The legislature narrowly carved out those exceptions. But we have to first get over the hurdle of is it an inherent risk. There was no statutory construction that occurred by the Court of Appeals. If we look at the plain meaning of the statute as the Code Construction Act requires us to do so, we have to look at the meaning of these terms within the context in which they're written. And we have to do so with an eye towards the objective of the law and legislative history and the consequences of a particular construction.
Thank you, Counselor. Are there any further questions? The Court is ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
May it please the Court, Mr. Derek Davis will present argument for the respondent.
Do you know how much you're suing for?
The amount alleged was...
You don't know either.
No, I didn't actually handle the trial. I believe it was $1.5 million.
$1.5 million because the saddle slipped sideways. How many saddles do you think slip sideways in Texas in a year?
I don't have statistics on that.
Probably thousands, right?
Could be.
And no question, the reason this was passed was so most of those people wouldn't be able to sue. That was the legislature's intent.
Well, the legislature's intent, as I read the testimony before the legislature and the statements they made on the record, was to take away... the cause of action for the rider, for the sponsor hasn't done anything wrong. So he's riding along, there's a lightning strike. Well,
how have you been able to recover in Texas when the up to the time of the statute if the sponsor didn't do anything wrong? Under what theory?
Failure to warn. The statute has
failure to warn would be failing to do something, would be doing something wrong, right?
Well, under a failure to warn case. Say you're riding along, there's a lightning strike, the horse bolts. The sponsor obviously didn't cause the lightning or any such thing like that. But the rider would say, hey, if you had told me these risks and told me how dangerous horseback riding is, I would never have done it.
The statute was solely aimed at failure to warn.
Well, that's its principal effect. If you look, the statute actually focuses on posting a warning and tells where you have to post it and what the warning has to say. That is the, it's principally what it does.
It's not really warning, is it? It just notifies them that you don't have a cause of action.
Right. You don't have a cause. It takes away that cause of action.
It's not a warning. It just says.
Or a notice, I guess, would be a.
I'm just curious on. Given the facts of this case, what is your proof going to look like? How can you prove that it was a failure of someone to properly cinch as opposed to the horse losing weight during the course of the day, or the saddle pad compressing, or the sweat of the horse, or Mr. Stieg improperly shifting his weight?
Well, there are, first, the slipping saddles become a focus, although it's not the only basis for negligence. As far as the slipping saddle goes, in the evidence before the trial court summary judgment was the affidavit of the president of American Horseman Safety Advisory Council. I forget the. She's an expert horseback rider who reviewed the deposition of the wrangler and said that the wrangler did not properly cinch the saddle. I think it was some issue of not kneeing the horse after you first cinch it to let it blow correctly, and therefore she didn't do it right. And there's also evidence of that the Stieg did complain that the saddle was loose while they were just walking along, so it wasn't something that was tight, and all of a sudden it slipped. It was loose, but they were walking. And
before before the ride?
Before the accident, before the horse ran off and fell. And that's in the Court of Appeals. You know, that is discussed in their opinion, I think.
Where in the statute is there a carve-out for negligence?
Well, it's affected by the term inherent risk. If inherent risk of equine activity, if it's going to mean something, then you've got to separate what is inherent and what is external.
What is inherent in your view?
Inherent is you're riding along, and a snake comes out, the horse bolts.
Well, the horse bolted here, and the horse ran and stopped suddenly.
Because the
and that's what caused the saddle to slip.
Right.
Well, and I know you allege, along with failure to properly cinch it, but there is some inherent activity here that caused the injury. How do you parse through the two?
And that's the difficult part, because you know the issue becomes, well, what if you've got inherent risk and you've got negligent conduct? Because in this case, we're saying, and the experts backing us up, that you don't lead a horse ride from the back where the people at the front can gallop out. You've got to be at the front and maintain control of the ride and not let people run. What when you have a situation where you've got negligent conduct, and the negligent conduct leads to a horse doing what horses do and injuring somebody? Now,
so all the statute did was eliminate cases where no reasonable person could allege anything but an absolute act of God caused it. Everything short of that, the statute didn't do a thing about. We're going to send all those to the jury anyway. So this statute was just against God, nobody else.
I see the statute is no.
Well, name me one situation that the statute stops now, other than your failure to warn thing, that wasn't protected before. What difference did the statute make?
Well, now if you're riding along their trail and the horse loses footing and falls over.
Unless you throw in an allegation, well, you should have been in the front, you should have been in the back, you should have had the horses in a different order, you should have had the horses farther apart, you should have had them closer together, you should have had a bigger trail, a smaller trail. I mean, lawyers are inventive people. They can always come up with something else, some circumstance that you could have done this trail ride out in nature some way where this might not have happened.
Well, if the act seems limited in what it provides to the sponsors, we have to go back to the sponsors' testimony, what they were asking for from the legislature. And that was exactly what they asked for, is the testimony appearing in our brief. They asked that they brought these examples of a boy being killed when lightning struck him, and they asked for protection against that. That's what they got. Now they would like some more. But it's not, they're in the right city but the wrong building if they want to get more protection out of the act than they originally got.
Let's assume that experts all agree that if you ride a horse for a period of time, it's going to need to be re-cinched. And so at some point, during the ride, there's going to need to be a re-cinching. Of course, it's not scientific. You don't know exactly when. Does the statute give any protection if you are a minute late for re-cinching? How do you that isn't, would you agree that's an inherent risk if you know it, that on a lengthy ride you're going to have to re-cinch?
I would say yes, it's an inherent risk of, well,
if you know,
if you, I guess if you know you're going to be riding for a long time, it's going to be hot and the saddle is going to come loose. Okay, that's part of horseback riding. I would say what's not part of horseback riding is, say, a wrangler who just ignores that situation.
But it,
says,
that,
oh, forget
that's
it.
My
I'm
question.
Not.
You're short on a continuum here. I mean, how long does, is there a standard the wrangler has to stop every 10 minutes, every 15 minutes, every 30 minutes,
you'd
every
have.
Hour? I mean, what protection does the statute give if it's a given that if you ride for very long, your horse is going to lose weight, actually, and there's going to be some perspiration and it's going to get slippery?
Well, the statute certainly doesn't provide any guidance as to specific situations. That, it sounds to me, as if that's an area of, you know, of really expertise. Only people who are very experienced in horse riding and wrangling are going to know what is when you need to re-cinch a saddle on a ride. But certainly the participants
not. Why shouldn't we follow the Cooperman case?
I believe the Cooperman case was wrongly decided. Because the job of this court is to define the Supreme legislature and what they were thinking when they put the statute
in. But Cooperman's analysis was that the slipping saddle is an inherent risk unless you can show that the cause of the slippage was something, was sponsor error.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Wasn't that what Cooperman held?
I'm not.
I had thought you were going to be arguing Cooperman in support of your position.
Okay. I'm sorry. I was thinking of the Wyoming case. That is the correct. If it's sponsor error leads to the slipping saddle, then it's not an inherent risk.
And what? How do you get there? How do you decide that on summary judgment? I mean, is the burden then on the plaintiff to show that there was something specific that the sponsor did wrong?
I would say, as in any negligence case, summary judgment is difficult. If the issue is, you know, did the wrangler exercise reasonable care, then that's a summary judgment issue that comes up in all sorts of scenarios, medical malpractice, whatnot. The plaintiff has to have evidence that the wrangler did something wrong. If you don't have evidence, then you're not going to get survive a summary judgment motion. And in the present case, we did have evidence.
Do you claim that there are disputed issues of material fact?
Yes.
What are they? Just list them.
You've got people not agreeing about whether there was a re-cinching midway during the ride. One rider says she doesn't remember seeing them do that. The sponsor said, yes, I did.
Someone doesn't remember whether it happened or not. The
right,
other says
there's
it did.
A dispute as to whether this was the first time they ran off or the second time they ran off and whether the ride leader actually gave them permission to do that. Ride leader said, I didn't give them permission.
So if you
rider
go...
Said, yes, she said it was okay for us to run away from her unsupervised. So there are...
Are those the only two? Court of Appeals, as you recall, reversed because it held that there were disputed issues of material fact.
Correct.
These are the two that you...
Well, whether the saddle was cinched properly. Our expert says that it was not, that they didn't follow proper procedures for cinching it. They said it.
Initially? The initial
correct.
Cinching?
Correct. Some about, if I recall correctly, and it's in her affidavit, about the horse not being allowed to either blow or... Was it kneeing the horse? I guess you're supposed to knee the horse before you tighten back down, something of that nature. So there's a disputed issue about whether the horse was cinched properly the first time, whether it was re-cinched, whether the Mr. Steve complained to someone else that during the ride it was loose
But Cooperman seems to say that the act of cinching is more of an art than a science, and therefore they're going to qualify that as an inherent risk. So if it's something other than just the art of cinching, and I guess that's the basis of my question, is has there been anything alleged here other than just error in judgment as to cinching?
As regarding the slipping saddle issue?
Yes.
No. Okay. The slipping saddle issue is error in cinching. The other issues in the case is not taking the lead position on the ride, not controlling the riders, allowing somebody who's only ridden a horse once in his life to go off at a gallop.
How would the case be submitted if it went back to trial? You would have, I guess, a general negligence question, that the negligence, if any, of the camp caused this incident. Then would there be an instruction on inherent risks to the jury? Do not consider, you know, in your deliberations anything that would amount to an inherent risk with a definition? Or how do you let the jury know that they're not being asked to find for this exempt part of the statute? You know, there's no liability unless it's an inherent risk. So how do you instruct the jury on that? You said a lot, you know, that a bolting horse, for example, well, that's part of horseback riding. And if the jury were to find liability because the plaintiff wasn't warned that the horse could bolt, well, that wouldn't be proper under the statute.
Right.
But you say, well, they could be found liable for some form of improper cinching or something. And so how do you instruct the jury not to consider certain aspects of the ride, but do consider others?
I think you instruct the jury that the sponsor is not liable for inherent risks of horseback riding.
And how do you define it? What do you tell the jury about inherent risks?
It becomes very difficult because the legislature didn't define it for us either. The legislature just gave us a non-exhaustive list.
Is that a legal question? Does the jury determine whether, you know, the saddle was actually loose a little bit before recinching or after recinching at the midpoint and before the accident? So the jury might determine that fact issue. And is it a legal question as to whether that's an inherent risk and whether the statute applies or not? Jury determines disputed facts, and then the judge determines the law.
It could very well be handled that way. I mean, if the jury finds that there was negligence on the part of the sponsor, and say if you submitted different issues, cinching the saddle, but you know, failing to guide the ride, and the jury comes back and say no, yes, yes, then the court would apply the law to that. Say, well, is this an inherent risk?
Is it negligence if you knew ahead of time that in the past this horse had tended to follow other horses, that if they trotted, the horse would trot? Would it be negligent to not warn, or negligent to put someone on that horse knowing it might run into a trot?
I would certainly argue that case, yes.
How big a fellow was Mr. Steve?
He's shorter than me. I would say about
250 pounds.
Maybe. He's shorter than me. I think he's smaller than me all around.
There are inherent risks in any sport. Right?
Yes.
And those, we can make them safe, but then we're going to have nothing but pony rides left, right?
Was it horseback riding?
We can make all horseback riding safe by tethering the horses to a circle and making them walk around like the pony rides do at the circus.
You could, yes.
But short of that, what can you do to make sure, you say, I don't want to get sued. It's not a matter of whether I'll win at the trial or not. I can't afford $50,000 or $75,000 for the attorneys. What does an outfit do, an outfit like this, and still do trail rides to make sure they won't get sued?
Well, the only thing they can do on a day-to-day level would be to conduct the rides as best they can, and you know, actually have experienced wranglers lead the ride as opposed to the person who's working in the kitchen the day before. And and just do the best job they can under the statute as it presently is. The other thing we could do would be to go back to the legislature.
What kind of college degree do you need to lead a trail ride?
There's actually there's not a degree, but there is they've got
basically, it's a world where we tell them all, don't let anybody run, don't let anybody trot, don't let any horses move out of line. I mean, what you're pushing us toward is pony rides, right?
No, I don't think so.
What's going to be fun in this horse ride that's going to be left?
Well, you'll be out in nature and riding on your horse. There's nothing... I'm certainly not trying to tell the a sponsor.
Can you have bareback rides? Can a camp give kids the experience that the Indians had and ride bareback, no saddle at all? That would be unreasonable, I assume, or at least something that ought to go to a jury.
Well, actually, there's in the statute actually has an exception if you don't match the skill level of the rider with the horse, then you're not absolutely not engaged.
So the answer is kids can't do that anymore.
Well, unless it's a well-skilled kid, I suppose.
How do you get skilled in bareback riding without doing it the first time?
Maybe you can do it with your parents at your own age.
Doing it with somebody that you can't sue. So only people who have done it with somebody they can't sue.
Or somebody can... as activities take place every day.
Bottom line is you can't do bareback riding anymore.
You can do it if you want to.
And as long as you don't mind getting sued.
It's a risky run, and maybe that's, you think the reward is worth it. Maybe you don't.
What was your client's specific evidence, if any, on the reason for the slippage? Was there any, if there was, what was the evidence on the reason for the slippage?
That it wasn't tight enough, you mean? Because it slid over to the side. Why it wasn't tight enough?
Yeah, it slid over to the side. What was your client's evidence on the reason why it slid over? Slid around.
Initially, when they girded the saddle, they didn't do it correctly. And there's some evidence that they also did not retention the cinch.
So it was too loose?
Too loose, I guess, to begin with. Not tightened down enough. Right.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Your Honors, the rider has fallen prey to the same errors that the Court of Appeals has, and that's trying to come up with disputed issues of fact that are not material to the legal question that was before the district court in interpreting the statute.
Is there a carve-out for negligence in the statute?
No, Your Honor, there is not. And in fact, of the 34 states the legislature looked at, for example, as specifically referenced, 19 of them have carved out specific negligence exceptions. They've seen fit to, in what would be our Section 87.004, along for willfulness and wanton and intentional acts, they also have negligence there as an exception. This statute doesn't, and it had the opportunity to do so. In fact, the House proposed doing that in the substituted bill, and in the legislative history discussion in front of the Senate, in the Senate Natural Resource Committee, the Senate removed that language because it was intended to be broader. A couple of facts that I do feel like should be distinguished just for clarity purposes. Mr. Steig did not, during the course of the ride, state that his saddle was loose. What that was testimony by Rebecca Freeman, another participant to the ride, who at the first part of her deposition said, well, he may have been complaining about it being loose during the ride and then was later questioned on it, and she said that she couldn't actually recall. The rider himself states throughout his deposition that he was able to control this horse well, that the saddle was comfortable, and that it fit. Those are the facts of the rider. Taking all facts and inferences in favor of him, there was nothing wrong with the saddle other than the inherent collateral risk.
We're focusing a lot on the slipping saddle, but opposing counsel is talking about there are other bases for liability here. Has there been an allegation that the rider was not appropriately matched to the animal?
No, Your Honor. At best, there's been an insinuation of that for purposes of the exception. It was never pleaded. That's not one of the negligence allegations that was pleaded. In the response to the motion for summary judgment, it raises an issue of he said that he only had a hadn't ridden in 15 years, Your Honor. But then on page 66 of the record, the writer concedes that he was able to handle the horse, that he'd had no problems.
Well, but that gets you into a factual dispute. I mean, have they pled the exception?
No, Your Honor. They did not plead the exception. Although it's found within their briefing, it's not found within their
All right, where would you put the allegation that the rod was improperly conducted by not having someone in front, having them in back?
Your Honor, I think that leads us directly to the line of questioning that Justice Brewster was engaging in. The only way to prevent any possible negligence allegation is to not put them on the horse. Even the example of the lightning strike, I would imagine we would see artful pleading that we should have checked the weather report better. I mean, there's always going to be these additional...
So what if they had sent a bunch of people off who had never ridden before just by themselves?
Your Honor, just by themselves, not being guided at all? Well, those are, it's the definition.
I think you're saying improper guidance, this exempts that.
That's true, and we should look again at what the intent of the statute. It was to be read broadly in favor of the sponsor. But if we look at the definitions of that section and what is entailed in the act, of what creates an equine activity, it has to do with managed trail rides. So the questions would become, should I have had two or three hands out there? Should I have been riding at the front or in the back?
Does the owner of Dude Ranch have any duty to its customers?
Of course, Your Honor.
What would that be under this act?
Your Honor, under this act, it would be to not behave in any manner that would fall within the categories of 87.004, which means...
Or if they put a cook from the kitchen to fill in on a bad day to cinch up a horse.
Your Honor, if a cook was sent out to improperly cinch up the horse, I think there are some of the exceptions. The other exceptions would be applied. For example, just like in the case of Sapone versus Grand Tarkey, also a Wyoming case, where there are additional broader fact patterns that are atypical of a horse ride. But, in Your Honors, we really should go back to the example of Cooperman and the imprecise nature of cinching a horse. That court stated it is not of scientific precision, and the mere fact that it's loose does not remove it from inherent risk. Thank you, Your Honor.
Pause is submitted and the court will take it.